talks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal, come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal, come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Laura Fletcher Taylor, co-founder of Loving Friends Transport, which transports animals from overcrowded shelters in one part of the country to shelters in another part, where they stand a much better chance of being adopted. They also transport animals from crisis situations like puppy mill raids, hurricanes, hoarding cases, and more. We'll find out about Loving Friend Transport, its past, its present, maybe its future, when we hear from Laura Fletcher Taylor in a few moments here on Talking Animals. If you want to know about our guests ahead of time, by the way, I urge you to subscribe to our email newsletter. Go to talkinganimals.net, and on the right, near the top, you'll see where you can subscribe just by entering your email address. It takes 3 seconds, maybe 5. Thank you. Later in today's show, a Name That Animal Tune will offer as the prize a copy of Kitchen Divided, Vegan Dishes for Semi-Vegan Households by Ellen Jaffe Jones, and signed by Ellen. We'll do that today by email as opposed to our usual call-in. Right now, though, let's hear an animal song. This is a Sheba with No More Monkeys on Talking Animals.
Okay, it's monkey time again. Children, you know you love to jump. So here we go. Five monkeys were playing on a bed. One fell off and bumped his head. Mommy called the doctor and the doctor said, no more monkeys jumping on the bed. 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 That is what the doctor said. Well, four monkeys were playing on the bed. One fell off and bumped his head. Mommy called the doctor and the doctor said, no more monkeys jumping on the bed. 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 That is what the doctor said. Well, three monkeys were playing on the bed. One fell off and bumped his head. Mommy called the doctor and the doctor said, no more monkeys jumping on the bed. 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 That is what the doctor said. Now, two monkeys were playing on the bed. One fell off and bumped his head. Mommy called the doctor and the doctor said, no more monkeys jumping on the bed. 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 That is what the doctor said. Now, one monkey was playing on the bed. He fell off and bumped his head. Mommy called the children and the children said, yes, more monkeys jumping on the bed. 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 That is what the children said. Yes, more monkeys jumping on the bed. That is what the children said. Yes, more monkeys jumping on the bed. That is what the children said.
Oh, you're gonna keep on jumping, yeah?
I think I will. I will keep on jumping. That was a Sheba with No More Monkeys, a peppy animal tune to get us started this morning. Let's move right into our chat with Laura. In a conversation recorded recently, this is the co-founder of Loving Friends Transport, Laura Fletcher Taylor, on Talking Animals. Good morning, Laura. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, of course, I want to discuss all sorts of aspects of Loving Friends Transport, and we will in a moment or two. But someone who creates something as cool and benevolent as Loving Friends Transport likely has a long and or profound history with animals, I'm guessing. So let's find out a bit about that side of things first. What was it like when you were growing up? Were animals a big part of your family, or what was that like?
Actually, it was a struggle. I loved animals, but my parents didn't want a lot of animals in the house. So,
and why was that? What were they?
Just against having more things to take care of. But okay. I was always, you know,
Was it a big family? Is that part of the reason?
No, actually, we have two other sisters and my parents, but we're all about 11 years apart. So,
interesting.
One would leave and one would come in.
I see. Taking shifts, basically.
Yeah. But I would always go out and capture animals that were injured or hurt or something like that and bring them home. I did possums. I did raccoons. I did all kinds of wild animals. So, yes, I was constantly bringing animals home.
Interesting that they were wild animals. So where was this? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Largo. I was born in St. Pete.
Oh, wow. Okay, mm-hmm. but so because often someone who does something cool like you, we find out that they were the neighborhood kid who did tend to the injured or,
yes.
or the sick animals, but not necessarily all as many wild animals. So were there right. other? So it was possums. It was raccoons.
Yes,
it was
possums, raccoons, squirrels. I don't know how many squirrels I've rehabilitated and
wow.
you know brought up from little you know babies and weaned them off of the milk and then let them loose.
And is that something that carried forward beyond your childhood, or is that?
Oh yes,
yeah.
Okay, actually,
you still do that now?
No, I actually had to stop doing that because it takes up so much time, and I'm on the road so much now, so that I can't
it's
really take
practical.
Them with me. Right?
Yeah, I gotcha.
Right.
Were there some pivotal animal experiences that said, "Well, I not only care about them and want to tend to them, whatever, but I have some kind of connection, some sort of profound connection."
I think so. I don't really know when it hit me. When I took care of that possum, I mean, that was probably the beginning. I think I was only 11 and learned how to nurse it and raise it and then let
and
it
what,
loose.
And what was wrong with it? What was it injured in some way?
Abandoned. Mama got killed by a car and the little baby was there. And I think somebody from up in North Florida brought it to me, a friend of a family. So I ended
And how
up,
did you nurse it back to health, or how did you know what to do, or just make it up as you go?
I think I asked my veterinarian, because, of course, then the internet wasn't available, so you couldn't look it up.
Yeah.
I think I asked the veterinarian, and they told me what to get, and I just bottle fed it, and then I let it loose after a while.
As far as you know, everything was fine.
Yep, everything
yeah.
was fine.
But that sort of set you on a course.
I think that was
like.
What set me on a course, and then I actually went to Ocala, and I worked with horses for a few years.
In what capacity?
Actually, all capacities. I was a stud manager, I was a breeding manager, then I was a foaling person that actually put myself through college, and I worked at night foaling out mares so that I could do my homework.
Oh.
So, and
very
I got
crafty, Laura.
Yes.
Yeah, I like that. That's good. So were you studying anything animal-related while you were going to college and doing this late-night foaling?
No. Ironically, I realized that there wasn't any money to be made in, you know, working with horses because it was just a daily care type of thing. So I actually put myself through college and got an accounting degree.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So post-college and post-foaling, did there continue to be animal adventures? I'm going to guess there were.
Always,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I was always helping, you know, rescues, disasters. I hooked up with some people during Hurricane Katrina, and it's actually called Disaster Animal Response Team.
DART.
We
love acronyms.
Yes,
yeah.
Bay Area DART. And I hooked up with them at Katrina, and we helped them actually bring supplies, and then we took some animals back. We didn't know we were going to do that, but we ended up
doing
it.
So that was a spontaneous thing, and that was the beginnings of loving a...
That was actually possibly the beginning of a thought as
okay.
far as, because we really didn't expect to bring the animals back. When we got there, they said, you know, we're so overwhelmed with animals right now. Could you possibly bring some back? So we loaded up, it was my mother's motorhome that we borrowed.
Oh.
And, we had about 17 cats on the bed, about five dogs on the dinette and an iguana in the shower. And we brought all those back to the SPCA of Largo, and it was about 2 years after that we actually started Loving Friends Transport, and that was because of a puppy mill dog that we adopted and learned of the plight of puppy mill dogs.
And so who was that guy or gal?
That little dog was named Lily. She just passed away this last July.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It was pretty heartbreaking, but
yeah.
she taught me everything. I mean, she's the one that really inspired us to build the truck and to actually go out and help, because we realized when they do a puppy mill bust, they can't really move the animals. They have no way of putting 700 dogs into one vehicle. So we built the vehicle to help them move the dogs out of the puppy mill.
So, okay, let's back up a sec. So Lily, when Lily came into your life, did you know that she was a puppy mill dog?
Yes.
And you expressly adopted her because she was a puppy mill dog?
No, it was by chance again.
Oh, I see. Okay.
The SPCA actually asked me to come in and help because they had so many dogs to take care of.
Mm-hmm.
And they had rescued all these dogs from Tennessee. I showed up and they thought I was going to fall in love with this little puppy. And across the room, this little dog just kept staring at me. And I tried to ignore her for the longest time. And she just kept staring holes right through me.
Yeah.
I went over to look at her cage before I left. A big note was on her cage, said, "Do not remove, scarred lungs, all kinds of pneumonia issues, possible broken jaw." Mm-hmm. I looked at her and I said, "Does this dog need to go somewhere to at least heal?" And Connie Brooks at the time was there, and she said, "Yes, she does need to go somewhere, because otherwise she may not make it out of here because she's so sick." She had such pneumonia that she sounded like an aquarium when she was breathing, and she would just hack up fluid, and, you know, there was just – she lived in a shed for 5 years, a metal shed in this southern Tennessee, And the ammonia smell is what actually infected her lungs and gave her pneumonia.
Yeah, burned them,
right? Right,
yeah.
And that's what the scarred lungs are. So I took her home and immediately just fell in love with the fact that she was so willing to accept new things. And it was like just watching a flower. I mean, that's why I named her Lily, because she just blossomed. I mean, she had never walked on grass before.
Yeah, yeah.
She had never heard the sound of birds. And just to
never
see her.
Played,
never
obviously.
Played,
obviously. Yeah, yeah.
Never knew what a toy was. So we nursed her back to health, and she's pretty much the inspiration for everything we do now.
What a great story. I mean, sorry, obviously, that Lily's no longer with us, but
right.
In terms of inspiring you to launch Loving Friends Transport. So you had done the Katrina thing, and you borrowed the RV, brought all those animals back, and then a couple years went by. So what was the thinking from, okay, because we did the Katrina thing, we know, and other sort of disasters or puppy mill busts or hoarding situations, that we're going to need this kind of space and this kind of accommodation? I mean, did you just say, this is what we're going to need to really help on the level that we want to?
Or? Well, actually, we were introduced to a gentleman named Ronnie Graves. He actually owns Sumter Dart, and he has been transporting since Hurricane Hugo, I believe, and he had been doing it for quite a while, but he only had one vehicle, and he was so overwhelmed with requests. So we went to him for direction and said, you know, what should we build that is good for the dogs? We didn't want anybody to be overheated, and we didn't want CO2 levels. And so he kind of nurtured us through the process of actually building the truck.
So did it kind of mirror the sort of vehicle he had developed over time? Or
it did, but I did it a little bit differently, only because he has stainless steel kennels inside of his, and I wanted removable kennels, because if you get a puppy mill dog that is scared to death of coming out of that kennel, you don't want to be reaching in and pulling it out. Instead, we can actually remove the whole kennel and take it right into the shelter.
I see. So born of experience,
yes.
Born of, sadly, of puppy mill experience, but again, much more effective,
yes.
Probably for you guys. Yeah.
Yes.
So is that the vehicle that today, because I know you guys just came off, you had another transport, I guess, last week, but is that the vehicle that
yes.
you use? And so how many, mm-hmm. when it's a full house, as it were, how many animals can it accommodate?
Lately, it's been about 103 to 115 is the normal load.
And is that typically dogs?
Oh,
I
yes.
Mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mostly all dogs. We've done a whole load of just regular house cats. And, of course, we do the big cats. We do the lions and tigers and
yeah,
cougars.
I definitely want to get into that in a sec.
Right. And that's a whole different ballgame. We have
yeah.
to actually pull everything out of the trailer to accommodate those cages. But the most we've ever had is 251 dogs. And that was during a puppy mill in Quebec, Canada.
So does that mean that in the way you described it, you're able to take the kennels in and out? Does that mean it can be configured or reconfigured to?
Yes.
Up to, because that sounds like almost double of what it would normally
yes.
accommodate.
Yes.
So.
Because usually we have large dogs on the bottom, so the large dog crate would actually take up the space of two or three more crates that we could get for small dogs. So if we don't have any very large dogs, we can pull those crates out and put two or three more crates in.
Oh.
So it is very user friendly that we can change it around. I mean, we've had loads that it was nothing but pit bulls, so of course every crate had to be a large crate. Well, then you can only get maybe 75 to 100. But, you know, we did the Seabird during the oil spill. And what we did then is we actually just lined the crates up down the middle aisle, because we didn't need to actually get to anybody on the truck.
Oh, I see. So it could be, yeah.
Right.
If you don't need access, hey, there's that much more space for, yeah, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Who created this? Vehicle, you guys?
Yes.
Or?
Yeah, we actually built the trailer from the ground up.
And I say you guys, it's you and your husband, right?
Yes.
That did this? Yeah.
Yeah, me and my husband, we went to order the trailer and had everything specifically made just to accommodate. We knew we wanted three levels of crates, so we actually had to make the trailer taller than normal. We knew where we wanted the lights. We knew how many fans, how many air conditioners, access doors, write-up tables, everything. We had it specifically made to our taste.
So other than the RV trip from Katrina, was that then just because of the guidance from Ronnie Graves that you, because I mean, it sounds like it's very sophisticated, and that only by doing a number of transports would you know what you needed, but
correct.
Sounds like this was the first real transport after the Katrina thing on the RV, or did I miss
some transport? No, no, it was.
Okay, yeah.
No, we,
so just based on that and just talking to him and just figuring out the most efficient way to use that space, you guys just created this.
Yes. Wow. Yes, and it wasn't easy, honestly. I mean, when you look at it, you can't get two large crates on either side of the truck. You have to have room for an aisle and also for the door openings. So you have to actually make one side shorter than the other side. And we had to actually configure all of that, and we did that actually by buying one crate, measuring it, and then figuring out how they were all going to fit. Well, in the time span of when we ordered the trailer, they changed the crate size.
Come on, without consulting you.
Yes, because it took 6 months to build the trailer. But
we
adjusted everything and got them all to fit.
And when you say, I mean, it was literally you two, or did you have people helping with what I imagine was welding and other things that
No, it was just my husband and I. He actually went to a place in Tampa and bought the racks used, sanded them all down, repainted them, fitted them in there, and we all did it ourselves.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yep.
That's cool. Must be really satisfying, though, when you saw that the finished product and said, okay, let's go on a transport.
Yeah.
We're ready to roll now.
It really was. It was. Yeah. We actually had a business at the time, so we were doing both. Trying to transport and run the business.
That was the motorcycle?
Yes.
Yeah. So, and what was that?
Yes. It was Fletcher's Harley-Davidson.
Right, which has a long, long history. And,
yes.
And was it just because you wanted to devote more and more time to transports that the motorcycles took sort of a backseat, as it
no,
were?
No, actually we had good people in place at the business. They knew how to run it. So we would only go about once a month, though. But now that we don't have the business anymore, we're going once a week.
On transports.
Yes.
Yeah.
On transports.
Yeah.
But the business, my father passed away in June, and Harley-Davidson was actually trying to downsize some dealerships. And they actually came to us and said, you know, we would like to just have one dealership in Pinellas County. And it was the opportune time to retire.
Oh, okay. So that wasn't onerous at all. It was like, hey, this kind of fits with our plans to go help more animals.
Right.
Yeah. So when you say now it's averages one a week, I mean, how does that actually work? I mean, I would think now that with the reputation that you have, with the array of different kind of animals that you've transported, and so much we'll get into more detail about hopefully in a moment, how does that work? Because I'm sure there's tons of organizations and situations that are vying for you guys to do a transport. How do you sift through the requests and say, okay, next week, here's where we're going to go, and here's who we're going to bring back, and here's where we're going to go with those?
Mm-hmm. It does get overwhelming at times when you get requests, especially during puppy season. June and July are our busiest months. Really, I try to accommodate whoever asks. If they ask me, you know, where do you go, how far can you go, when can you go, I'll try to schedule it out as far as I can. I really haven't turned anybody away yet, I don't think, unless I'm actually physically on a transport. Our hardest ones are, of course, going up north. We try not to go up north during the wintertime because of everything that, you know.
So it becomes so unpredictable, probably, right, as far as,
And we don't want to get trapped on the road with animals, which happened once, but luckily it was only with tigers, and they can stay in the trailer for as long as they want. Dogs are a different story. They need to be walked and fed. We really haven't turned anybody away, and that's actually why I'm glad you asked me here today, because I'm trying to get the word out to shelters that we are available. A lot of them don't even know we exist.
I mean, in other parts of the country, because there's sort of, if I understand correctly, there's sort of a regular route that at least brings you wherever you begin to the Tampa Bay Humane Society, and I think also in Sarasota.
Yes.
So that's kind of a pretty standard route for you. But are you saying other organizations and shelters, like, you know, throughout the country don't know, and that if they did and they asked you guys to do a similar transport, that you would?
Yes. Yes, definitely. Actually, even the shelters here in Florida, a lot of them don't realize that we can bring them animals. If a shelter, let's say in Palm Beach, has no puppies and they would like to have puppies in their shelter, then all they have to do is ask, and we can pull puppies from Mississippi or Louisiana and bring them to them. So I'm looking for sending shelters and receiving shelters.
So we'll come back to this at least one or two more times, but what is the best way, because I gather the website lovingfriendstransport.org is sort of got some minimal sort of bare bones information about links and contact. Is that
correct?
The best way, or would you recommend the Facebook page, which seems to be
the Facebook
even
page
more active?
Yes, so that's more accurate. It lets them know if we're on the road or if we're going on the road, where we're going, that type of thing. Like a lot of shelters will ask me if I can just pick up one or two dogs on the way if I'm already if I have room, I'll do that. That happened with that pregnant dog in Macomb, Mississippi.
Yeah.
And I had a crate available, so I said, of course, if you'll meet me at a rest stop, I'll take it for you. So, yes, if I can, you know, get the word out to them, that's
sure.
what we're trying to do is help as many.
So at what point would you, I mean, because it seems like as people hear about this, they would say, oh, my gosh, this is fantastic. But at a certain point, it would tap out, and I would think, of capacity, even though we know that capacity can expand handsomely, you know, in the vehicle. But, I mean, just in terms of the physical capacity that you and your husband have about, well, if we're going this way, we can only go this week there. So, mm-hmm. I mean, and I don't know how many a week you – I mean, what's the most you would do in a week? Is it one a week?
Usually really one – Yeah, one a week is usually the max, only because we have to have time to get there, time to load, and time to come back. And then 2 days it takes to actually disinfect the truck. We have to pull every single crate out and disinfect top and bottom. So you're talking at least 5 days to even complete a transport.
And I guess we should sort of address, because some people might be listening and saying, well, geez, as far as I know, shelters near me are having trouble, you know, they're at capacity. So can you explain a little bit how it works where some shelters, seasonally or otherwise, are able to find homes more quickly, and therefore when you do a transport, you can bring those animals there and they will find a home?
I think what it is, it's the diversity of animals that we bring. In Mississippi and Louisiana, it's amazing. People turn in animals that we would see in pet stores. They turn in Cocker Spaniels, Shelties, Poodles, all kind, because they're more of a hunting dog type of state. So the ones that are fluffy and cute are usually turned in. Down here in Florida, what do we see mostly turned in is pit bulls and, you know, dogs that have some issues sometimes. So when we bring them from other states, it is kind of like what they talk about in retail store, that if you have the product, people will come. That person may actually come to the shelter thinking they're going to adopt that cute little puppy they saw on the web, but they may pass a kennel that has an older dog that's been there for months, and all of a sudden they see that dog and they fall in love with it. So it actually helps get the people to the shelters, even if the puppies aren't even available or they just want to see them. They end up walking out with a dog that's been there forever.
So the idea is it's a matter of movement in all senses of the term.
Correct.
Really. Yeah,
interest and movement.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. I should let folks know this is Talking Animals. My guest is Laura Fletcher Taylor, co-founder of Loving Friends Transport, which typically transports animals from crisis situations like hurricanes, puppy mills, hoarding cases, and more, but from shelter to other shelters we've also just addressed. And this conversation was recorded recently. So let's talk about some of the more interesting transports. You just alluded to it, and we sort of traded email about this. So tell us about where you were sort of in the delivery room, in a sense, as you were on the road.
Yes, Macomb, Mississippi, the animal shelter there, asked me to transport a pregnant dog. And we had it all set up, and we actually thought she was going to give birth before we actually loaded her on the truck, so I wasn't too worried about that. And I already had two mothers with newborns on the truck as well. So when I have that, I'm very, very busy because I have to make sure that all of those puppies are warm and safe. So when she was deemed just pregnant, I thought, oh, no problem. Well, I picked her up in Hammond, Mississippi. They met us at a truck stop. The woman that delivered her to me said she started panting very heavily on the way down, and I thought, this is going to be a long trip. I put her in the back for the moment because we were stopping at the agricultural center soon, and I said I would check on her then, but when I lifted her, I felt she was very squishy. I had a feeling it was going to be that night that she gave birth. So I actually asked my husband to pull over before that. I checked on her. Everything was fine. We pulled over at the agricultural station to, you know, check in with our paperwork. And all of a sudden, I noticed her looking at her back end, and here comes the first puppy. And my husband is actually in the station with the officers going over the paperwork. I run into the office, and I said, please help me. I got to get this dog in the cab now. And she started giving birth right then and there. And
so when you say that, sorry, did you mean you moved her from the overall trailer area to the cab where you and your husband normally would ride? Is that for her to deliver at least the rest of the babies?
Because actually our cab is a motorhome. It's a 17-foot motorhome. So we have a bed. We have a kitchen.
I see.
So I actually put her on the bed and had all the diapers there, so, you know, the fluid and everything, but moved her inside so that I could keep an eye on her. And asked the officers at the ag station if this has ever happened. And they said, no, it's never happened before. And I said, well, it's happening now.
That's for sure, yeah.
And we stayed there for the first four. because we weren't sure how she was going to do. But she did pretty good on the first four, and we needed to get back on the road. So she took a break, and I said, okay, let's get back on the road. All of a sudden, number five came, and that one was okay. But number six and seven weren't so good. She decided that she'd had enough, and she quit pushing. So number six that she started pushing out came out halfway, but the sack broke and the head, and it was breached, so the head was still, yes. So I had to, you know, finish the job for her, and once I got the puppy out, it wasn't breathing. So my instincts kicked in from the horse foaling days, and I started clearing out the airways and doing all of that and rubbing it and getting it dry. About 10 minutes later, it started fighting back. So I knew that it was going to be okay. Number seven was pretty much the same way.
Came out the same way, breech, and yes. You had to sort of kickstart.
It came out breech, but it didn't break the sac at all. So I actually had to pull it all the way out, break the sac, and then take the fluid out of the puppy.
Well, again, it's as we've seen now, you're sort of collective from the when you're the possum when you were a little kid all the way through the fooling and beyond. All that experience is brought to bear, I guess, on any given transport. So, but that was sort of a first, I gather, to that degree of
actually on the road. Yes, yeah. I've delivered some, you know, at home. I shouldn't say home, but, you know, in this county.
Yeah.
But never on the road before. So that was an experience. And I didn't really know how she was going to take it, if she was going to quit. But she just kept, you know, rolling with the puppies and had seven total.
And from your just experience with all these dogs and, unfortunately, puppy mills and other things, I mean, did you know when you saw her before she started delivering, like, about how many puppies it would be? Or can you sort of eyeball that from experience now? Or,
yes. Yeah. You can actually kind of see them, and I started feeling around, and I actually knew that there was at least five. Two of them were very small, but after she gave birth to the five, I thought maybe we're done, but I went back and felt, and you can actually feel them. I mean, they just feel like, you know, hot dogs in there. And I felt at least one more, so I knew that there was going to be at least six.
And so how is it, because you mentioned that even as this was happening, you were sound like you kind of had your one eye on the mother and the puppies, but another eye on the clock. So how does that work? What is the normal timetable for a transport? And is it essentially, even though it sounds like you have sort of, you know, RV home kind of quarters there, the idea is to just blast through as quickly as you can, generally?
Yes. Generally, we stop every 4 hours to check on them, water them, and we also give biscuits out just to make everybody come to the front of the cage so that I know everybody's doing well.
I see.
But
very clever.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
It's about 14 hours is the normal, and we drive all the way through the night. My husband and I both drive, so we switch off driving duties.
So somebody can snooze if needed.
Right. He'll sleep for a couple hours while I drive, and then I'm the main animal handler, so I go back in the back and take care of everybody. And
While the vehicle's moving?
No, we stop.
Only for stuff.
Right.
Yeah,
okay. We stop and do that and check on everybody. And if there is somebody that doesn't look very well or gets a little bit, you know, car sick, we bring them up front in the cab with us.
Nice. Mm-hmm. So what percentage is sort of the shelter-to-shelter transport as opposed to, say, puppy mill, bus, hoarding situations, kind of more immediate crisis situations?
Mm-hmm. As far as time, you mean?
Well, I mean, the frequency that you would encounter in a given period of time, how many would just be sort of more standard transport as opposed to crisis kind of intervention, hey, we got to get these out of this hoarding situation or this puppy mill bust or whatever.
The hoardings have actually gotten worse. They've increased really probably about five times.
Just the frequency of them, you mean?
And the number of animals, right. I think it's because of the economy. But the puppy mills have kind of backed off because of the economy, because they're actually putting some of them out of business, which is a good thing.
Okay, yeah.
So because people aren't going to go to pet stores and buy a $1,000 dog in this economy. So the puppy mills have actually backed off a little bit. The hoardings have increased. So I would say we do a shelter transport once a week, a hoarding or a puppy mill or a disaster once every 3 months.
I see. Okay, and again, just as needed. But are there... But even as far as those kinds of things, are there just a select few organizations so far that know they can call you for that?
Yes.
And are you also hoping it to sort of fan out a little bit?
Hoping to fan out. Actually, the way that they find out about us is we also work with the HSUS, the ASPCA. They'll call us in for an overcrowded shelter. And then once we get that connection with that shelter and they see what we can do for them, then they'll call us back to continue doing transports. So the ASPCA or HSUS will call us in an emergency situation. You know, if a capacity of 50 dogs at their shelter and all of a sudden they have 150, they'll have us transport those 100 to surrounding facilities. So then once we actually make that contact, they'll say, you know, well, we have this problem every month. You know, can you please come back? And that's how we make the contact.
I'd be interested to know, like, is there always a place in the situation you described, for example, is there always a place to take what might be 50 or 100 dogs that are beyond the capacity at the shelter that you're helping with? I mean, is there always space to take them, or how does
it seems like they always find a space.
Okay.
We have done as many as 5 stops. So if we have 100 dogs, we might drop off 20 to each facility, especially if they're the dogs that need a lot of care, like your hoarding dogs that have mange or something. They don't want to overrun one facility. So they'll have us drop off 20, you know, to different shelters. So we might make a loop from the west coast of Florida to the east coast of Florida dropping off animals.
It's so interesting because, again, I think a lot of people would think you hear so much, especially, again, back to the economy, that so many shelters are tapped out in space. And mm-hmm. and many of them, unfortunately, there's not the kind of adoption rate to sort of thin that out. So mm-hmm. it's just interesting to find and encouraging this in those situations that there still are places for those dogs to go in those
yes.
situations, because otherwise you think, no vacancy, we'd love to help you, but
right.
no room here.
No, I think the shift is going away from people buying dogs in pet stores
yeah.
and actually looking to the shelters, because they're realizing that there's full-blooded, you know, dogs there. Like, there's poodles and there's all different kinds of breeds that are actually purebred.
Yeah.
And you can get one for $75 versus $7,500.
Yeah, it's so funny. I mean, we talk about this a lot on the show about, of course, just emphasizing adoption generally, but also that people who want or need, they think they need a very specific kind of breed. And, you know, with Pet Finder and some other things, it's like, hey, well, we need, you know, we've got allergies, we need this kind of dog or whatever
right.
it might be. You can do that and still adopt. You don't have to pay the
$7,500
back to your example or
yes.
something. So, yeah, all right. So that mm-hmm. that's a really encouraging trend then, it sounds
yes.
like.
And
yeah.
we actually also deliver dogs to the rescues here. We work with Great Pyrenees Rescue, VIP Rescue. VIP is very important poodle.
Okay.
And it's non-allergenic. Dogs.
Okay.
So we
yeah.
actually pull from the shelters and bring, you know, purebred dogs to those rescues.
So that's a very specific kind of transport in that case.
It is, but we yeah. actually do it in conjunction with the shelter transport. So if I have room,
see.
I'll put a Great Pyrenees on for Great Pyrenees Rescue. I work with Golden Retriever Rescue, and I just brought 2 of them down here that were heartworm positive. They would have been euthanized if I had left them at the shelter. But Golden Retriever Rescue will take them, and now they're both adopted.
That's great. So it's a lot of these are sort of general transports, but then off in this corner here or this kennel here, there's some very specific things that are going
right.
to a specific location within.
Yes.
That's great.
It gets a little complicated, but.
Yeah, I think the logistics of
it
like.
Is.
Yeah, but you've probably gotten a pretty good system developed to
yes.
track all that.
Yes, and I write everything down, and that's actually why we have to stay on a time schedule a lot of times, is Beagle Rescue will be meeting us at Tampa to pick up their dogs. So I have maybe 5 or 6 different rescues meeting us, you know, at the facility.
Yeah, don't be late or it kind of throws off
yes.
everything probably. In,
yes.
in a, so let's talk. I think we almost are required to talk about, because so much of this is dogs and you said occasionally cats. But let's talk about big cats, just because I don't know how often that's happened, but I know there's been at least 1 or maybe 2 tigers and stuff. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about how that
okay.
came about and how it actually went.
Actually, we're on number 7 or 8
Oh,
now.
Okay. Wow. All right. I'm a few behind then. Okay.
That's okay.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a trial by fire. Once you actually survive the first one, then you're going to be called again. It actually happened with Big Cat Rescue. They actually put out a call on their Facebook page that they needed help moving some tigers from Texas. And they were getting everybody with horse trailers and that type of thing offering, you know, to help. And I saw it, but I just kind of ignored it because I thought, well, that would be totally crazy to transport a tiger. Well, one of my friends knew about our truck and offered us up.
Oh, I see. Nice to volunteer
yes.
your services, right?
Yes. Yeah. And said, yeah. I know of a person, contact her. And Carol at Big Cat Rescue did contact us and asked if we could move these 3 tigers. I said, well, please come look at the truck because I want to make sure that it's the right setup. And she did, and she said immediately, it's perfect. So we actually had to take all the racks out and all the kennels out to actually roll in, you know, 3 tiger cages.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And so once they're loaded in, is it similar to other transports? It's easier.
Easier.
How so?
Because once they're enclosed and you're not bothering them, they settle right down. They sleep. You don't have to feed them. You don't really want to enter the trailer at all. You want to just leave them alone. And we have cameras so that we can actually view everything that's going on in the trailer. We also have canine temperature sensors so we know what the temperature is in the trailer. So we really didn't have a need to go in and look at them, which would just upset them.
Sure.
And so they actually generally roll over on their back and fall asleep.
That's great.
So
from the time they're loaded in, they just kind of chill. And then when you arrive at Big Cat Rescue or wherever, they just then you unload and that's pretty much it.
Yes. But the loading and unloading is the dangerous, thrilling
difficult.
Part.
Yeah,
It all depends on the tigers. The first load that we did with Carol, luckily her daughter Jamie went along with us and Gail. They taught us the ropes, how to stay away from the cages, how not to look them in the eye. These three were extremely angry. They wanted nothing to do with humans, and they charged the cage a lot.
Had there been an abuse situation
or
something that yeah, I would assume.
Yes, they actually came from New Jersey and lived in mud up to their ankles for years, and it was not a good situation. But I know what the term is, frozen in fear. I know that now.
Okay, yeah.
When they charge that cage, it is extremely intimidating, and the roar actually goes through your body almost like a rock concert, and you are frozen in fear. But they taught us the ropes, and that's how we kind of got into all of this, and now we work for the USDA, IFAW, all those big organizations that have us move tigers.
Interesting. So again, we're sort of nearing the end of our time, but my guest is Laura Fletcher Taylor, co-founder of Loving Friends Transport. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. This conversation was recorded recently. With that in mind, Laura, are there other animals, exotic or otherwise, that you've been asked to take or would consider taking, or is there a line that's drawn somewhere? Or
I would say the line would be drawn at anything that would be really, really dangerous. Actually, I'm scared to death of apes because they're smart and they'll watch and they can figure out how to get in and out
of the
crate. But if they were in the proper, crate, I would be okay with it. We were going to actually transport a couple of wolves, but we were already on a transport, so couldn't do it. But we have been asked to do quite a few things. I'm waiting for the rhinoceros.
Well, I wondered if something that big, and I'm sure you could not accommodate like an elephant or something.
No.
But I think about elephant transport and some of the challenges that go with that.
Right.
But
I would consider a rhinoceros as long as it was in a crate that couldn't puncture.
Yeah, right. keep your horn to yourself, sir.
Yes.
Yeah. So. Well, this is really, really great. And what's the kind of most rewarding aspect? Obviously, you've been doing it a while. You clearly have it down. It still sounds like it's kind of trying, if not exhausting, when you're in the midst of a transport or the tail end of a transport. But what's the most rewarding aspect of doing it, and has that shifted over a while of doing these now?
No, it's actually stayed the same. The most rewarding aspect is when we see the dogs adopted. A lot of the shelters will actually post photos of those dogs, with their new family. That's pretty much our payment. I mean, when you see that dog cowering in a cage at an animal services building, and all of a sudden it gets transported out, gets adopted, and it's smiling from ear to ear with that new family, that is all the payment that we need. I mean, that's what we do it for.
Sure. Well, before we finish up, Laura, brings me to the other kind of question I did have is the funding involved. I mean, these transports must be no cheap dates and just fuel and stuff alone. So how is Loving Friends Transport funded? Is it grants? Is it other sources of funding? I mean, donations, some combination? How does that work?
It's a combination of everything. A lot of the shelters will get grants to actually do the transports. And, of course, the ASPCA and HSUS have, plenty of grants to fund transports when shelters are overcrowded, but they have to go through those organizations. If it's shelter to shelter and they just want us to come up there, it's normally that we just ask them to pay the fuel. And my husband and I pretty much take care of everything else as far as the cost of the rig. Our time is donated.
For every transport and all the other expenses, food, et cetera.
Yes.
Although, I guess you guys probably just eat on the road in kind of the RV part of the thing, right?
Right. So. We sleep and eat in the RV, so it doesn't cost anything. It's just, the cost of the rig and our time. But that's what we donate to the cause.
That's great. Do you see any kind of changes afoot when you look ahead, or just obviously trying to get more people aware so that there's more people availing themselves of your services?
Actually, we're branching out. What we're doing is we're actually teaching the shelters how to apply for grants to get their own transport trucks. So we have at least three shelters right now building their own trucks, and we've already established all of the connections as far as shelters that will receive their animals. So we don't really want to do this full time. We don't want to actually be out there for 10 years doing this. We want people to take the lead, build their own vehicles, and transport their own animals. And then we can kind of step back and just nurture everybody to do this.
Sure.
And that's actually what we're working for.
And you're effectively creating a network of these sort of transport opportunities. So that'll be eventually you'll be able to sort of pull back a little bit and maybe enjoy some other parts of actual retirement.
Right.
You're certainly not enjoying at the moment as much, it sounds like.
Exactly, so, yes.
Well, that is fantastic. Well, we've been speaking with Laura Fletcher-Taylor, and the organization is Loving Friends Transport. The website is lovingfriendstransport.org, or again, perhaps more effectively, go to Facebook and just search for Loving Friends Transport and find out more about them and see some of the animals they've helped and how you might help as well. So, Laura, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Let's step now into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. Last week, we heard the first half of Jake Johansson's newly aired piece on whale watching. You may recall where we left off, Jake was starting to talk about one possible downside of going whale watching, getting seasick. So, this is Jake Johansson with the second part of a piece called Whale Watching on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
And then by the time we get to the place where the whales are supposed to be, my wife and I are at a point with our seasickness where we are not throwing up, but 100% of our consciousness is devoted to not throwing up. That's all we can. I think we've all been there at some point from drinking where, you know, you're just hanging onto a pole kind of... I'm okay, don't touch me. And then that's when the guide says, well, there's a whale off the right-hand side of the boat. So, of course, we're all, I would love to see that whale. And then you get over there and you see the tail of a whale, a huge whale, it's about 200 yards away, but the tail goes up and then boom, right? Classic. And I thought, well, this is awesome, let's go look at that whale. And then the guide says, no, they're usually down for 2 hours after that behavior. Right, like he's, well, so we saw that whale, and I'm like, well, I didn't really get a good look at it. And then he says, we have to go find more whales, and he said we saw two more whales. I'm pretty sure one of those was a bag. But by the end, you don't want to get off the boat. You're like, just high five, that was a whale. Let's go back. And then by the time you get home, you realize what a dumbass you are, right? Because we all have a TV full of whales right in our house. You know, you can DVR whales on demand when you go home, right? Or you can take the guesswork out of it. That's what we did. We rented a National Geographic whale watching DVD, which I recommend. It's 2 hours of nonstop whale. Every minute of the DVD has a whale. Even when there's a guy talking, there's a whale behind him. Like, well, I'm still here. Yeah, if you want to feel like you went whale watching, just open a can of tuna while you're watching the DVD and give it a sniff. Because, yeah. Tuna smells just like the ocean. And then if you want to, you know, you can put your fingers in there. Oh, that was a big wave. Or if you want to be 100% authentic, you just throw $50 out the window and make yourself puke on the rug. Yeah, you just went whale watching.
That was Jake Johansson for the second part of a piece from Jake called Whale Watching, taken from his most recent appearance on Letterman. I'm Duncan Strauss. Towards the end of the show, we'll play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive a copy of Kitchen Divided, Vegan Dishes for Semi-Vegan Households by Ellen Jaffe Jones. The copy signed by Ellen, no less. A nice inscription related to talking animals. So we'll do that coming up. And again, we'll do that today by email as opposed to calling in to try to win our fabulous contest. We'll get to all that in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Right now, it's time for animal news and announcements. And I'm going to try to get us caught up a little bit. We didn't have a chance to do any animal news and announcements last week when I had that great interview with Francis Batista from Best Friends Animal Society about No Kill LA and... just had to cut short some things, so getting to some news that's not necessarily new news now, but still worth noting here. So that includes this bill that was introduced by a state legislator from Santa Monica that would prohibit orca shows at SeaWorld in San Diego. That bill by Assemblyman Richard Herschel Bloom, a Democrat, would make it illegal to use orcas for performance or entertainment purposes. It would also ban captive breeding done at SeaWorld of orcas, also known, of course, as killer whales. The bill is supported by PETA and others and is prompted by the documentary Blackfish, which was highly critical of the use of orcas at SeaWorld parks and centered on the death of a trainer at the park in Orlando, Florida. And, of course, we had Blackfish director Gabriella Kelperthwaite on the show just a week or so within the release of the film theatrically. As state legislation, the bill would apply only to the San Diego Park, the only park in the state with orca shows. Quote, these beautiful creatures are much too large and intelligent to be confined in small concrete pens for their entire lives, Bloom said in a statement. Other statement issued by SeaWorld, the park said the bill, quote, appears to reflect the same sort of out-of-the-mainstream thinking of activists who went to court in San Diego in an unsuccessful bid to have the orcas declared slaves under the U.S. Constitution's 13th Amendment. SeaWorld is one of the world's most respected zoological institutions and already operates under multiple federal, state, and local animal welfare laws, the statement said. The bill will most likely be opposed by some legislators and other officials with districts in San Diego, where SeaWorld is a major tourist attraction and economic driver for the region's economy. SeaWorld is in the district of Assemblywoman Toni Atkins. Atkins is set to become Assembly Speaker this summer. Bloom, a former mayor of Santa Monica, is in his first term representing a district that includes much of West Los Angeles and Hollywood. March signals the beginning of the annual sea turtle nesting season in Florida, where loggerhill and green sea turtles are found in numbers not seen anywhere else in the United States. Sea turtles live out their lives along the continental shelves of almost all the Earth's ocean, aside from the Arctic. Females must return to sandy shores to lay their eggs. Thanks to conservation efforts by the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission and concerned volunteers, biologists are hoping to match the success of last year when more than 36,000 green turtle nests were identified along Florida beaches. From now until October, thousands of volunteers will patrol more than 800 miles of shoreline to count, mark, and safeguard sea turtle nests. But the focus on turtles goes far beyond Florida's shores. Female sea turtles lay between 1 to 8 nests per season, each containing between 50 and 200 eggs at a time, depending on the species. While they produce a lot of offspring, the estimated rate of hatchlings that reach adulthood is only about 1 egg per nest. Couple this low survival rate with the increase in man-made ecological threats, and it's easy to understand why nearly all species of sea turtle are listed as, quote, vulnerable, endangered, and critically endangered under the IUCN Red List of Endangered Species. I want to wrap up today with telling you about an event on the horizon. It's the Hogs for Dogs event coming up Saturday, April 19th at Brandon Harley Davidson on Adamo Drive in Tampa. There'll be adoptable animals, food trucks, vendors, raffles, prizes, DJ and line dancing lessons. Pet friendly, it'll be rain or shine. It'll be from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday again, April 19th. And it's sponsored by animal-based charities. To find out more information, you can call 813-380-5674. For more information. All right, I'm Duncan Strauss. You are listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to Name That Animal Tune. This is a giveaway, and you do not need to be a WNF member to win. There'll be a prize, a copy of Kitchen Divided, Vegan Dishes for Semi-Vegan Households by Ellen Jaffe Jones, and again, signed by Ellen to the first person who emails. That's right, today we invite your answer by email at duncan@wmnf.org and correctly identifies this animal tune. I'm talking animals. Who let the dogs out? Who let the dogs out?
Well, the party was nice, the party was pumping. Hey, V-I-O. And everybody having a ball. V-I-O. Until the fellas start their name calling. V-I-O. And the girls respond to the call. I have a pool with shout out.
Okay, I think that's what we call in the business a gimme. We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. I'll be back next Wednesday, March 26th, when my guest will be Janice Wolf, who runs the Rocky Ridge Refuge in Arkansas, an animal sanctuary perhaps like no other, in that dogs and cats coexist with an array of other critters, such as a capybara, a zebra, a tortoise, deer, miniature horse, and more. And they all seem to hang together. Find out all about that when we speak to Janice Wolf. Hope you'll join me for that next Wednesday. Also, hope you visit our website, talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information, as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals programs. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook, the show and or me personally, and follow us on Twitter. and subscribe to our email newsletter. It's easy, and then you'll be in the know a couple days ahead of the show. Who's coming on? What are we talking about? What else is going on in the Talking Animals world? That's all found at talkinganimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. We're closing out today's show with an animal song, Instrumental Beatles Division. This is Brad Meldow with his version of Blackbird, WMNF, Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwatchee, and beyond. Thanks for listening. Speak with you again next Wednesday at 9 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks.